is Olivia, and you're listening to Bikini Drive-In. Bikini Drive-In's mission is to analyze horror and science fiction films through an intersectional feminist lens, while combining elements of screen and media studies, arts criticism, and women and gender studies. Since we'll be discussing portrayals of horror and violence, content warning, listener discretion is advised, etc. Also, spoilers ahead. Today, I'm joined by Allison Lang. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, my internet friend.
Yes, internet friend. Allison is a writer and editor based in Toronto. She writes for Rue Morgue and wrote a book called Women with Guts in the Rue Morgue Library. She also makes zines and is currently working on part two of her Music Men Ruin for Me series. Along with Esther Splett, she co-hosts a bi-monthly Facebook movie series called Toxic Films, focusing on movies about hags, harpies, lesbian sluts, and monstrous women. This week, we are discussing Antonia Bird's 1999 film, Ravenous.
We're sending you to California, Fort Spencer.
We have four missing soldiers, Captain, and no bodies. We need a supportable explanation.
Captain John Boyd is about to discover...
No one just ends up at Fort Spencer. We come for a reason.
Yours being?
Well...
Something he never imagined.
We have a great sense of camaraderie here at Fort Spencer.
This Indian scout told me a curious story.
Winged eagle.
It's an old Indian myth from the north.
Man eats the flesh of another. He absorbs the other man's strength.
Now, one man must choose.
We need others.
Between having dinner.
Not man.
And being dinner.
Good gracious.
That's so annoying.
Stew a la Major Knox.
Guy Pearce.
Ives!
I'm gonna kill him.
Robert Carlyle.
He was tough, but then a good soldier ought to be.
Jeffrey Jones.
I bring you into the fold.
What's wrong?
David Arquette.
There's no guilt. I gotta eat. But it's tough making friends.
Eat to live. Don't live to eat.
That was really sneaky.
Oh! He was licking me!
Ravenous.
Bon appetit.
Ravenous is a 1999 Western horror film directed by Antonia Bird and starring Guy Pearce, Robert Carlyle, Jeffrey Jones, and David Arquette. Set in a remote corner of California during the 1846 Mexican-American War, Captain John Boyd, played by Guy Pearce, begins a journey to hell when he and a small motley group of soldiers banished to a desolate military outpost in the barren and icy Sierra Nevada mountains face off against a sadistic cannibal, played by Robert Carlyle, in a deadly struggle for survival. And I have a quote here by Simon Abrams from The Village Voice. The film ends with a drawn-out, quasi-homoerotic murder-suicide precipitated by a man-sized bear trap. So, all you need to know. Allison, what is your history with Ravenous, and why did you choose this movie?
My history with Ravenous is, this is almost 10 years ago. I was living in Halifax, and my downstairs neighbor, who was also a very close friend, he broke his leg, and it was right at the beginning of the summer, and he realized he would be essentially housebound for the entire summer, and summer is quite a big deal in Halifax, as I'm sure you know it is in other provinces where weather is very inclement, such mm-hmm. as perhaps Winnipeg mm-hmm. or Montreal.
So
we were like, oh my god, your summer's ruined in Halifax. So we created a movie theater in the backyard. We just set up a bed sheet, put out a bunch of chairs, we had a fire pit, and we just started opening it up to pals and like friends of friends in the neighborhood. Every weekend, Friday and Saturday nights, we would just show movies there.
Oh,
and it started small and then kind of grew bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm.
But my pal is quite a movie buff. He used to work at a video store, and he chose a lot of the films, and we kind of like, we let him choose them because he was infirm.
Yeah.
And Ravenous was one of the movies he chose. And my memories of Ravenous were seeing the trailer when it was on TV in, you know, 1999 when it came out, I guess, as a younger person, and being like, wow, this movie looks intense and violent and super weird. And like, but I never saw it. Like, I think like a lot of people, it just kind of flew under my radar. And I think it was also, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later too, it was not advertised in the best way. I think the people who marketed it like had no idea what the fuck to do.
Yeah, definitely.
As probably as evidence when people hear the trailer that you just played, it's like very incongruous with the film. I find
it's very like, this is a story of a man, like that kind
yeah, they're portraying it as a hero's quest of some sort.
Yeah, definitely.
It's really
no.
But yeah, long short story short, yeah, we watched it, and in the backyard with the trees all around and, you know, the fire burning, it was just the perfect setting to watch that movie. And I was completely captivated, like, from beginning to end. I was just like, this is so weird. It's so perfect. Like, I loved it. Like everyone else, I was completely bewitched by the soundtrack. I was like, I don't even understand.
Yeah.
Like, it fits. It's so weird, but it works. And the ending, like, I died laughing. I was like, this is so fucking funny. Yeah. It's so weird. Like, yeah, apologies, my phone is going off, but, just turn that off. But, yeah. And then ever since then, I think it's grown in stature for me every time I see it. I just love watching it. I love to rewatch it. I see new things kind of every time, that I enjoy little nuances here and there. Yeah, I think it's one of my favorite movies. Like, and it just seemed like, as a topic for this show, it's so in alignment with your own interests as well, especially with regards to female directors who kind of tackle stories that are really, you know, weighted with male figures and male characters and archetypes, but put a very particular gaze and like a very particular lens on these types of films. And I think Antonia Bird did that really successfully with this Western, or, you know, pseudo
whatever genre this is.
And what about yourself?
Ravenous was recommended to me by a coworker a few years ago now, while I was working at a record store and movie rental place, RIP Music Trader. I was definitely apprehensive at first, because it's just like, I just assumed it was going to be macho, because it's like about a group of dudes. But yeah, I really like it. It's such a strange movie, and a mix of so many different themes and genres, and I think it works really well because it's very critical of masculinity and colonialism and the sort of American individualism and greed and all that. There's just so much going on in this movie. I think it's great.
Yeah.
So yeah, there was a troubled production on this film. So after 3 weeks of shooting and disputes over budget and the schedule, Fox 2000 executive Laura Ziskin arrived to the set with director Raja Gosnell, who had only directed Home Alone 3 at that point. And so they dismissed the original director with Gosnell. And then, I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce his name, Manchevsky?
Manchevsky.
He left the production. The cast was said to have rejected Gosnell. And then Robert Carlyle then recommended Antonia Bird, his frequent collaborator and business partner, to take over. And Antonia Bird only had 6 days to prep before filming, which I think kind of adds to the feeling like this feeling, this film, it feels more like an indie movie rather than like a studio film.
Yes.
In a lot of ways. Maybe it's like the writing, the music, like everything. It just feels smaller than it actually is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I was thinking about that too when I watched it more recently, is that it's kind of brilliantly small, like their world, it's so small. It's, I mean, even though it's in the vast forest of the Sierra Nevadas, it's mostly just like, you know, aside from the outdoor caper that they all get into, it's pretty much all set on the base camp. Which is, but yeah, it feels much less expensive than it actually
definitely. But yeah, it still works. And it just seems so wild to me that such a big studio would take a chance on this film because it is so odd.
Yes.
And yeah, like you mentioned, like they didn't seem to know how to promote it at all or how to market it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's yeah, it almost had sort of, I remember the trailer or the way it was cut, it had like sort of that Dimension Film style scream, like lots of splashing sounds and
yeah,
and it failed to share. I mean, I guess you can't really share the funniest lines in that context, but like, or have a seamless way of showing it. But like, I remember all the lines in the trailer are stuff like Robert Carlyle being like, you know, eat to live, don't live to eat, kind of thing. Just very ominous. And yeah, it's so surprising when you actually see that. But yeah, I read a review, I don't remember where, recently, where someone was saying, you know, it's a total hodgepodge of a movie. It's basically been, because it was handled by so many producers and because there were three different directors, and it was like the prep was so quick, like it shouldn't work. Like it shouldn't, this hodgepodge type of movie, like 9 times out of 10 is like a pretty incoherent disaster that like doesn't work tonally. But yeah, for somehow it, this just is perfect. Like it just all, everything magically collided together.
Yeah, it worked together. Yeah. And speaking of tone, I just want to talk a little bit about the score. So it was by Damon Albarn of Blur and Gorillaz and composer Michael Nyman. So yeah, it sets the tone of the film rather than telling the audience how to feel. So, you know, in a lot of like sort of emotional scores, like whenever there's any sort of tension or a climax in the film, you know, like the music swells and then you're sort of, yeah, you're sort of like brought along by this music. But I feel like in this film, it like, yeah, like as soon as, I think it's Boyd's journey when he's on his way to the camp, it's just this kind of weird harpsichord, Western. Yeah, it's just like so wild and like so weird. But at the same time, you're like, you're told what sort of movie it is and sort of what to expect like from the story.
We'll be right back.
that's what anchors it in the end, mm-hmm. is that the story and the characters are very strong. Mm-hmm. So, and the performances are solid. Like, mm-hmm. everyone is it's a very well cast movie, I find. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, it's kind of brilliant casting David Arquette as like a gibbering kind of, but kind-hearted nincompoop.
Yeah. It's like, and he's also kind of like their caretaker. Like, he's in a more of a domestic role. Like, he's kind of like the Wendy to these like lost boys in a way.
I did not think about that until I saw it in your notes. Mm-hmm. And it's totally true. Like, he is like the one. Yeah, he's one, the one sent out to do the errands, mm-hmm. and he's the one. Yeah, he's always like the one at home, mm-hmm. on home base kind of thing.
Yeah,
yeah. His death is the only one where I was like, aww. Yeah,
poor guy. I do love the scene where Boyd is sort of fantasizing about killing. I forget David Arquette's character name. I'm just going to call him David Arquette. But, like, fantasizes about killing and eating him. And that's just, like, it's so gory and, like, surreal. But also, like, kind of beautiful and, like, strange.
Yeah, it's very, there's something. I know everyone, like, throws Lynchian around all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do it right now, I think, just because I don't have a bigger framework than that right now, I think. Yeah. But the scene, especially when that fantasy is happening and David Arquette is just laughing with, mm-hmm. like, a mouth full of blood, it's just, like, so amazingly absurd. It's, mm-hmm. it's just, like, you're just like, what? Like,
yeah, what's happening? Yeah, Lynchian, but, like, wild at heart Lynchian.
It has
similar tone to that.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Just to talk a little bit about the idea of manifest destiny. So manifest destiny, a phrase coined in 1845, is the idea that the United States is destined by God, its advocates believed, to expand its dominion and spread democracy and capitalism across the entire North American continent. So it's just this extension of American greed, individualism, and white supremacy. And yeah, I think this movie does a really great job of, like, looking at that critically, which, yeah, maybe it's because Antonia Bird is, like, a British woman and a filmmaker and, like, has worked on TV. Like, she has that distance from the subject matter that she's portraying.
I think that's 100% mm-hmm. what it is. Like, mm-hmm. I think if you had an American director, that kind of would have been lost, mm-hmm. a little bit, or just blurred or changed. Yeah, not to say an American director couldn't have achieved that tone, but I do think her, because she's an outsider, mm-hmm. she was able to take a look at things. Definitely from a much more detached way and have the ability to be critical. She was also a social activist in the mm-hmm. UK. Like, she was really concerned with issues, you know, surrounding homelessness, mm-hmm. and LGBTQ rights and all that kind of thing. So I think she brought, I think a lot when I think about this movie, about how she brought that sensibility to the story. Mm-hmm. I think, like, I'm not sure who's, and I know this is kind of jumping ahead because you talk about this a little later, mm-hmm. with sort of the portrayal of masculinity. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure if it was her that brought the idea to the table that, like, Robert Carlyle and Guy Pearce should play up their sexual tension, mm-hmm. or if it was the two actors who decided to do that. Mm-hmm. But somehow she was able to give them the space to really, within the framework of this very, like, masculine, mm-hmm. domineering, like, American. Yeah. She just was very open to, like, subverting that. Mm-hmm. In a really sly way.
Yeah. Almost to the point where it's like, is this intentional or is it not? Mm-hmm. I think it's very clever. And kind of like, it's interesting how cannibalism is framed in this movie, how it's like, it's still a taboo. It's still, it's very, like, tempting, but in the way that it's, like, closer to vampirism. So it's, like, kind of sexy, and then you'll have all this power, and, like, but then there's still this, like, sort of tempting homoerotic element to it. I thought that was very cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally.
I was listening to Switchblade Sisters podcast, and one of the guests was just, they were talking about Ravenous, and apparently it was originally not written as a comedy. I think that would have been a disaster, just to play this as, like, a straightforward sort of, like, period war film or drama.
Yeah, I tried to think about it. It would have been pretty, yeah, I mean, I don't think it would have aged well.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Yeah, that's funny to note. Yeah, I guess I'm not sure what happened to the script, but I know that the screenwriter, I think his name's Ted Griffin, he went on to write Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
And yeah, I guess you can kind of see the seeds in this script a lot. There's just so many like little, yeah, there's like little throwaway lines.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very like quippy and like lots of like little jokes. Yeah. Like throwaway lines like that.
The most recent time I was watching it, there was a joke that really made me, I was like, ah, when Guy Pearce first gets to the camp, and it's like this total throwaway line, and Jeffrey Jones, I cannot remember, let's just call him
Jeffrey Jones, yeah, definitely.
I can't remember all the colonels. but he's talking about, like, how he likes to read, like, you know, arcane texts written in you know, old languages, and he's like, do you have any hobbies, Boyd? And Boyd's like, swimming.
Yeah.
And there's like a beat, and it's like totally deadpan. I was like, that's fucking hilarious.
Oh my God.
They both like stare at each other, and yeah, it's really, the script is brought to life in that way so well. Mm-hmm. Like, the actors were all so totally all on board for this, obviously, that it comes out really nicely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to go back to your point about how masculinity is portrayed, I watched Point Break for the first time last week, and I've been thinking about, like, how cis, straight, male intimacy is always sort of filtered or mediated through, like, violence, war, or in Point Break's case, like, extreme sports. Like, they can't just be, like, yeah, they can't be sort of, like, intimate or platonic or, like, close with each other in any sort of way without these other sort of violent factors.
It's a good point. It's like, I think about that with the Fast and the Furious movies too.
Oh, which yeah, definitely.
I had never seen them before the pandemic, if you can believe that. It's quite embarrassing. But my partner is a huge fan, and he was like, he like will go to see them all in the theater.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he showed me, I think, the first four, and I know there's so many more to go.
Yeah, I definitely watched them like beginning of quarantine too.
Yeah, I think a lot of people did. I think they're just very deeply comforting.
Yeah,
I certainly was comforted by them. But Dom's relationship, oh my God, with Paul Walker, his name I can't remember. I was really pleased to, like, I know that they have to, like, go through all these capers and, like, they're tough guys and, like,
doing car stuff.
Doing car stuff. But I did appreciate there is a lot of tenderness in the male relationships, and a lot of, like, very, yeah, there's just, like, a lot of, like, camaraderie and, like, but yeah, it's funny that it has to be framed again through this hypo-macho culture of car racing. Like we're just like not able to deal with like depictions of male tenderness, it seems, or even chemistry, you know, like even in, because Boyd's chemistry with Calhoun is so it's delicious because it's so antagonistic, and that's where their chemistry it like boils over so many times, but it seems like they need to be placed through some sort of violent trauma or swaggering. Did you like Point Break?
I did. Yeah, I like parts of it. I do feel like, it's weird how, like, I feel like Kathryn Bigelow did this with Near Dark as well. Like, how there's, like, a token girl so that the two main Dew characters can have chemistry, but then there's no chemistry between, like, the romantic interest and the main boy. Because there was definitely more chemistry between Patrick Swayze and Keanu Reeves rather than Tank Girl and Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
Which is, it's just, like, very funny that, like, those sort of, like, gymnastics that we have to go through to, like, avoid any sort of, like, hint of gayness or anything. It's just, or queerness or anything. It's just, like, very silly.
Yeah, I really enjoyed your comments about, you know, the male-female relationships in Near Dark and how there's, I agree. They're, like, they really bring the movie down.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
I want more Bill Paxton and that other guy. Like, I guess, yeah, the family. I just, yeah, the family was, like, so much more dynamic to me and more interesting.
I guess the nice thing about Ravenous is that there is no room for any women here. There's no room for even a pretense of a heterosexual, a typical heterosexual partnership. I feel like that's exemplified, too, when, right at the end when Boyd and Colquhoun are, you know, embracing each other in a literal bear-on-bear. Yeah. I know they're not both nuts. They're both too small to be bears, but they're like, you know, it's in a bear hug.
Yeah.
And Martha, like, walks in.
Yeah.
And she's just like, hell no!
Yeah.
She turns.
No, thank you.
I'm just like, this is not, this was never for me. And you guys just, that's fine.
Yeah, I gotta go. Yeah, I do really appreciate that, like, Martha isn't sexualized or objectified in any sort of way. Yeah, there's no, like, forced romantic story with that, because that just would have, like, taken away. Because, like, what's the point of that especially in this story? And, like, there isn't really a scene where, because she knows about the Wendigo myth, but she's not, like, seen as hysterical. It's not like she's not believed. The same way that Boyd is, he's like deemed a coward. He's almost like the final girl in that way. Like, he's kind of like hysterical. He's not believed. He's basically like the damsel. I do appreciate that Martha wasn't put into that position.
No, that's a good point. Like, she is like in they do in their way respect Martha and to, I think, a lesser extent, George.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's funny the way they're introduced to Geoffrey Jones's character. He's like talking about each of the people in the camp, and he's like, and that's Martha and George. And he was like, they kind of came with the place, you know, it's like their furniture kind of thing. And you're like, okay, like, clearly you've made no efforts to have relationships with these people.
Mm-hmm.
But then it kind of goes along, and he has no relationships really with anyone who's there. Like, he's kind of very dismissive of all of them. But, I mean, he does listen to George when he tells the story. And I do think there is a semblance of, like, caution that starts to be taken when George kind of tells them about that. And, yeah, and then, you know, again, in the end, like, Martha does have sort of a quiet kind of authority or something. There is, and maybe it's the actress, her presence is, brings that to the character where it may not have been written, but it is. It, thank God, it was not some sort of Pocahontas type.
God, yeah.
Like, oh God, I just I can't even imagine what that would look like.
Yeah.
I don't think Antonia Bird would have gone for a movie like that based on you know, the little that I know kind of her values and things like that. But it's a good point that you got to take what you can get with late 90s films.
Yeah, and, exactly. Yeah, definitely. So on that note, I have a quote here from Craig Draham, I'm not sure, from Rue Morgue. The piece is called White Terror in Native Lands, and they're describing the Wendigo. The Wendigo is a spirit or creature from the First Nations Algonquin tribes that possesses or is a possessed human with madness and an insatiable hunger, money, power, destruction, human flesh. The more they try to quench their appetite, the stronger... Oh, it's my dog. The more they try to quench their appetite, the stronger and hungrier they become. Within horror, the name has become an umbrella term for many Indigenous American-inspired stories, as can be seen on lists that references movies such as Wolven from 1981, Manitou from 1978, and even Skinwalkers from 2007. However, these works find consistency in their Indigenous characters by placing them as expositional roles to the white protagonists. So we see this in Ravenous in the characters of Martha, played by Sheila Tosi, and George, played by Joseph Running Fox, as the Indigenous scouts. So they're just sort of there to pass this mystical knowledge onto the white people. Unfortunately, and like this is, I feel like this is what happens when Indigenous characters or people of characters of color are written by white people. Yeah, it's a shame that they didn't do more with George and Martha, because I feel like they could have brought a lot to the story.
Yeah, it's definitely, I saw quite a good lecture that Miskatonic put on a couple months ago, and it was just about Indigenous horror, and it was given by an academic based in California. Mm-hmm. And she talked quite a bit about the very specific trope that you're describing now, where the indigenous characters in so many films are just like these disposable people who like come in and out, and they come in to like, yeah, provide knowledge to the white characters, and then they're either killed or they just disappear from the story. Mm-hmm. Like they're just not given anything else to do. And yeah, she cited examples from like, I think it's Poltergeist 2, which I haven't seen in a million years, because it actually scared the shit out of me. Pretty scary, or I at the time, I'm sure it hasn't held up at all, but there's an indigenous character, at least played by an indigenous actor, although that's like kind of cold comfort, but and that, like, she was describing it and she played us the scene, and it's exactly what she described note for note. This indigenous character appears and is like, hey, I'll help you, blah blah blah, and let's even do a ritual together where I provide you, white man, with my, you know, these powers I'm invoking through my culture. And then the character literally disappears. And like the dad from Poltergeist, like, gets all this knowledge and power.
It's like,
And it's striking how that happens over and over. Mm-hmm. And like, once it's pointed out to you, you know, by people, you know, by that art, like Remorgue article, that very good article, that you mentioned, or like the, by other indigenous thinkers or academics or writers, then it becomes so unmistakable that you're just like, oh geez, like,
yes, embarrassing.
It is embarrassing. Yeah. It shows such a lack of imagination, and on behalf of, like, you know, the white creators who borrow these things. And I have to say, I think the Wendigo is one of the worst. You know, it's one of the most overused. Like, anytime there's it seems like you need a convenient explanation for some kind of cannibal narrative. Like, it happens in like Pet Sematary. Like, there's
And then that's also tied in with like the Indian burial ground trope.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, I think, perhaps the most overused one. And I know there's so many people who have written about that. I wish I could cite some more specific examples, but you put so many good ones into our episode notes, it's certainly given me a lot to look at after this as well. It's just so goddamn embarrassing. It's just like, let's try something else.
Try something literally else, please. Anything. It's so interesting that, like, and frustrating that this movie can, I guess it's similar to, like, I talked about this in the Silence of the Lambs episode too, where like a movie can do so well dealing with gender dynamics and being critical of toxic masculinity and colonialism, all at the same time, like, kind of failing its indigenous characters. Whereas Silence of the Lambs, like, does a great job with, like, dealing with sort of like misogyny that Clarice Starling has to deal with, but then like totally failing, like, the trans character that it's trying to villainize.
Yeah, that's such a good point. It's always, I feel like this is kind of the crisis of being a horror fan in 2020, is that you revisit all these properties, as you are doing with Bikini Drive-In, and every single time you're like, oh God, this was like, this was so important to me.
Yeah.
These particular scenes, you know, where Clarice Starling is experiencing sexism within the FBI and all this, and working her way through it, and then, but yeah, then you see Buffalo Bill and you're like,
oh,
like,
yeah.
this is not aged well.
Yeah definitely.
Like, there's actually nothing, obviously it's bad, he's a murderer, but there's nothing bad about what he's doing in front of the mirror.
Exactly.
And in fact, it's very normal, and like, it's or, you know, whatever framework the movie has with regards to normal and abnormal. But yeah, and it's the same thing with Ravenous, where it's like, there's so much about this movie that I admire, you know, and we've talked about so many aspects of that. And I love how homoerotic it is. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very progressive as a horror film in that way. There's, you know, there's not a lot of horror properties that really lean into that and are unafraid to kind of let the actors play in that sandbox. But then there's other failings with regards to representation.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that's the show this week. Thank you, Allison. Thanks so much. It's so nice to speak with you and hang out with my internet friend for a little while.
Yeah, man. Thank you so much for having me. And I should also mention that Olivia curated a Toxic Femmes screening not too long ago and did such an amazing job. I really hope that she does one again with your amazing taste in short filmmakers and movies and music. And would love to do that with you again.
Oh my gosh, thanks so much. Yeah, I'd love to. We got to do all the Nightmare on Elm Streets.
Yes, and we have to watch all the Nightmare on Elm Streets.
Yeah. 24-hour marathon of all the Elm Streets.
I would do it.
Yeah.
I'm sick.
Yeah,
I'm
sick. Yeah, we're all staying home.
Yeah.
Tune in. Please follow Toxic Femme Films on Facebook. And where can people get your zines?
Oh, what a question and a good one. You know what? If you follow me on Instagram, mm-hmm. It is, I think my Instagram name is Gabba Gabba Ghoul at the moment.
Your Halloween tag?
just a real easy name to just type right in there. You can also just put in Allison Lang and I think that will come up. And I'll definitely be posting about the zine when it's ready to go.
Yeah, I'm excited for that. I have the first volume.
Yeah.
And Women with Gets is also available through the Rue Morgue Library. So check that out. It's such a great collection. And you can listen to Bikini Drive-In every Sunday at 4:30 on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Bye.
Bye. Shooting from the hip. Crazed and insatiable and rich.
You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM, Winnipeg.